From the newsroom of PCJ Radio International, this is Focus Asia Pacific. I'm Keith Perron. Moves by Beijing to boost the economy have yielded slightly faster than expected growth. China's economy had been expected to drop, but it grew by 7%. The numbers failed to boost Chinese share markets. They were, after all, unchanged from the previous quarter, and they do represent the lowest annual growth since 1990. Business editor Susan Lannan reports.
It's been a turbulent few weeks for Chinese authorities as nearly $4 trillion was wiped off the country's share markets. They breathed a sigh of relief today when official figures showed the economy had expanded by 7% over the year to June. China economist Julian Evans-Pritchard is from Capital Economics in Singapore. He says government measures like interest rate cuts and infrastructure spending worked.
Well, we weren't particularly surprised. Actually, we were one of the few groups that were forecasting a strengthening of growth. We've seen some improvement in the underlying economy over the last few months. But also on top of that, we've had this surge in stock market trading activity, and that feeds into the services component of GDP.
Retail spending and industrial production rose over the year. A statement from China's National Bureau of Statistics said the result was hard won. It noted that the domestic and international economic environment remained complex. Fred Newman, chief Asia economist at HSBC in Hong Kong, says the figures are better than expected, but China faces challenges.
The improvement in activity is more on the service side rather than in construction. Construction is still a very big sector in China, and that continues to slow, which raises really challenges for the second half of the year.
Does that mean there will have to be more stimulus from the government and from the People's Bank of China?
It looks very likely. There are two things that have changed in the last several weeks. One is that the equity market has sold off, and that will likely put a damper on spending over the second half of the year. The other thing is that we again have evidence that construction spending continues to slow, especially in the housing sector, and that accounts for about a fifth of GDP. And as that continues to slow, more stimulus is required to stabilize this.
7% annual growth was in line with the government's target, but more than many economists expected. Julian Evans-Pritchard says he does have some issues with China's official statistics.
We do have some concerns over the reliability of the official growth data. I mean, for one thing, the official GDP numbers, growth numbers, are oddly stable. They haven't really moved around that much over the past couple of years, you know, which is unusual for an economy like China. We don't necessarily think that the trajectory of the official figures is unreliable between the past two quarters, but we do think that real growth is actually probably about 1 to 2 percentage points lower.
The bad news for Australian iron ore miners is that crude steel production fell. Fred Newman thinks iron ore prices will stabilise, but only because small miners will stop producing.
A stabilisation in prices perhaps due to lower supply coming on stream, but not because China is again going out and buying enormous amounts of raw materials.
The trial of an Australian journalist and his Thai colleague began this week on the Thai island of Phuket. Alan Morrison, a former senior editor of the Age newspaper, and Chilota Sandrasetan faced charges over a report they posted on the news website. It wasn't even their story. It was quoted by a report from the Reuters news agency. But its allegation that Thai naval officials work systematically with smugglers to profit from the surge in fleeing Rohingyas from Burma clearly struck a nerve. Sources close to the pair say Thai authorities would have dropped the case if they'd apologize, but both maintain they've done nothing wrong. Several human rights and press freedom groups agree, and they're calling for the case to be dropped immediately. Mandy Sammy reports.
Freedom. I'd like to stay free.
Australian Alan Morrison and his colleague Chutima Sedisetian have been fighting against charges that relate to the publication of a story on website PhuketWan.com since December 2013. Today is the first day of their trial. Alan Morrison says the fear is it could end with them in prison for up to 7 years.
There's the prospect of jail. We don't think it's likely because we're innocent, but, you know, I guess it makes us very concerned about the future.
Mr. Morrison and his colleague are charged with defamation and violating the Computer Crimes Act. The defamation charges relate to one paragraph published on the website, which cites a Reuters investigative report alleging some Navy officials work systematically with smugglers to profit from the surge in fleeing Rohingya refugees. The Reuters news agency was honoured with one of journalism's most coveted awards for the story, a Pulitzer Prize. Thai authorities haven't gone after the Reuters news agency for the story, but publishing the same report online has had very different consequences for those working in Thailand. Alan Morrison again.
Well, this action predates the arrival of the military government, and we'd hope that the military government might see sense in creating a better atmosphere between it and the media, but they've chosen to continue the case, which indicates that the future of the Thai media is not going to be rosy. Unfortunately, the Thai media is also fairly subdued about these kinds of issues, and freedom of the media doesn't get a big run in the Thai press the way it should.
Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, the International Federation for Human Rights, and the Southeast Asian Press Alliance are just a few of more than half a dozen international organisations that have expressed outrage that Thai authorities haven't dropped the charges against the journalists. Elaine Pearson is the Australia Director of Human Rights Watch. She's worried this case could set a precedent.
This is actually the first time that any of the Thai armed forces have tried to use the Computer Crimes Act against journalists. And so we're really concerned about the precedent that this sets in terms of, you know, basically shooting the messenger and going after critical journalists that write stories that the military government doesn't like. And particularly in an environment where the Prime Minister, General Prayut, has made statements like, oh, it's okay to go out and shoot journalists or to execute them. I think, you know, we're really very concerned about freedom of expression right now in Thailand.
Have the journalists had much support from the Australian government?
I understand they have had some support from the embassy, and I think that the embassy also is paying quite close attention to these issues. But I believe there have been some concerns in the past before things had gotten to this stage that, you know, perhaps the Australian government hadn't been, you know, making as much noise about this case as they would have liked.
Human Rights Watch Deputy Asia Director Phil Robinson has been in regular contact with the journalists. He says they've been unfairly charged with serious offences for simply doing their job, and they're not willing to back down.
There has been an effort, I guess, between the journalists and the Prime Minister's office to try to reach some sort of accommodation to drop the matter, but those negotiations failed because the government insisted that they apologize, and the journalists said, apologize for what? We didn't do anything wrong. And in this case, the journalists are absolutely right. You know, it's the government that instituted this wrong-headed prosecution, and the government should step back. You know, this has really been all about trying to shut down some outspoken voices. I mean, there's been an ongoing intimidation campaign by the military government in Thailand to try to control the media. And Phuket Wan is in the front line of that. If they are taken down in a very serious way, and certainly if they are sentenced to any sort of prison time, it's going to have an extremely chilling effect on the media throughout the country.
What do you think is going to happen?
You know, I would expect that the Navy is going to push for a conviction, and then the question will be whether these people get any sort of prison sentence or whether they get a fine or whatever. But knowing Alan and Oi, what if they're found guilty of any of this, they're certainly going to appeal. This will not go away, and they're not going to back down.
The official history of Australia's role in the Vietnam War is set to be rewritten to correct the record of wartime exposure to chemicals, including Agent Orange. Veterans groups have waged a long campaign to have the official record updated, as Nick Grime reports.
It was codenamed Operation Ranch Hand. Between 1961 and 1971, the United States Air Force sprayed tons of the chemical herbicide known as Agent Orange over large areas of Vietnam. The tactic was based on the premise that if the might of the US military couldn't eliminate the Viet Cong's resourceful jungle fighters, then the Americans would eliminate the jungle instead. as this news report of the time explained.
This kind of attack is being made increasingly difficult by spraying a non-toxic type of weed killer on the jungle growth bordering special forces camps, important road routes, and likely ambush areas.
But Agent Orange and other chemical cocktails used during the war were not as benign to humans as it was claimed then. Far from it. In Vietnam, it's been blamed for high rates of serious birth defects and other deformities. Dioxins within the defoliants have been linked to a range of cancers and other diseases. Australian troops fighting in Vietnam were also among those exposed to the chemicals, and members of the Vietnam Veterans Federation of Australia have waged a long campaign for recognition of the suffering it's caused them and their families. Graham Walker was an Australian infantry commander in Vietnam.
In 1993, the medical division of the US Academy of Science identified quite a list of cancers, non-Hodgkin's disease, soft tissue sarcoma, prostate cancer and others that were linked with exposure to Agent Orange. And this was really when the tide turned. The US Academy of Science couldn't be dismissed. And from then on, the momentum of that carried over to Australia. And now quite a long list of cancers are recognised for compensation purposes for veterans.
In fact, the list of diseases linked to Agent Orange includes leukaemia, cancers of the throat, lung, colon and liver, both Hodgkin's and non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and a range of nerve, digestive, skin and respiratory disorders. Now, after a campaign that's lasted longer than the war itself, the War Memorial will commission an independent historian to write a new volume of its official history, one which it promises will take account of 25 years of new information and accounts from veterans themselves.
Look, as with any history itself, new information can be uncovered and new histories are actually able to be written.
And Benny is the Assistant Director of Public Programs at the Australian War Memorial.
The Memorials Council has certainly considered this for some time. The Council was certainly aware of the veterans' concerns that the official history does not contain the full extent of medical issues related to their service in the Vietnam War. So the Memorial has undertaken a scoping study, which has allowed us to look at whether, in fact, there is merit in evaluating new information in order to produce a new independent history of the medical legacies of the Vietnam War.
Can I ask you this? Why does the official history need to take account of the lingering health impacts of what occurred during that conflict? Should an official history just be a simple record of actually what happened without actually examining the consequences of those actions?
Look, that's a good question. Official histories provide often an operational commentary, an operational record of what went on with that conflict. I think the medical and the medical impacts are often seen in a number of our official histories, certainly in the Second World War, and again there has been a volume produced in the Vietnam War. It really looks at medical war or the medicine at war and the medical aspects as relate to a particular war. It's seen as a thorough review of the deployment and the service that those troops have undertaken.
And you're listening to Focus Asia Pacific, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. Australia's Foreign Affairs Minister Julie Bishop is adamant that Indonesia's decision to slash its Australian cattle imports isn't related to diplomatic issues. Australian cattle producers have been told Indonesia will only allow 50,000 head of cattle to be imported into the country between July and September. That's down from 250,000 from the previous quarter. But neither Ms. Bishop or the Agricultural Minister, Barnaby Joyce, or the federal opposition have been able to explain Indonesia's reasoning. From Canberra, Australia, Samantha Donovan reports.
Indonesia has decided it will import just 50,000 head of Australian cattle in the third quarter of the year. That's down from 250,000 head this quarter. The Foreign Affairs Minister, Julie Bishop, says the cut in the quota isn't related to Australia's political relationship with Indonesia.
We are in constant communication and I'm assured that it's a trade negotiation. It's not in relation to the overall Australia-Indonesia relationship, which is very strong and very good. As I've said on a number of occasions, I'm in constant communication with Retno Marsudi and we continue to be so.
But the Queensland MP for Mount Isa, Rob Catter, believes Australia's lobbying of Indonesia to stop the executions of drug traffickers Andrew Chan and Myuran Sukumar is partly to blame.
The thought of it makes me pretty angry that so many people indulged in attacking Indonesia on that issue and provoking them, and now we're counting the cost, and once again, the people of Western Queensland will be paying the price. I think it's terribly unfair. We're already suffering from the last live export ban that was, again, politically driven.
The Australian Livestock Exporters Council can't explain Indonesia's decision, but its CEO, Alison Penfold, is adamant diplomatic tensions over issues like boat turnbacks aren't to blame.
No, absolutely not. We don't support the view that this has got anything to do with any other issues in between the Australia and Indonesia on other areas of interest. This is a matter purely involving production issues in Indonesia and supply issues to consumers. It's got nothing to do with anything else.
You don't believe there are any political issues touching?
No, I don't. No, I don't.
The opposition spokesman on agriculture and rural affairs, Joel Fitzgibbon, isn't sure if political tensions with Indonesia are to blame for the cut in the quota.
We do know the relationship with Indonesia has deteriorated since Tony Abbott was elected, but these things are far more complex. What we do know is that it's a relationship that needs constant care and attention. It's very clear that both the Prime Minister, the Trade Minister and the Agriculture Minister have been asleep at the wheel. People are now looking for some guidance from them.
A clearly deflated Federal Agriculture Minister, Barnaby Joyce, says the Indonesian cut is disappointing.
It's something that I hope we can rectify soon. I'm not here to comment on the internal operations of another nation. Obviously, I would like the opportunity as soon as I can to meet up with Sir Rahman Gobel and Mr. Amran Suleiman, who are the respective ministers responsible in Indonesia for the importation of live cattle.
Mr. Joyce denies that live cattle exporters are paying the price for any diplomatic tensions with Indonesia.
It's important for competition in the marketplace, and it is something that we work extremely hard towards maintaining a good relationship, and it's also vitally important to our cattle producers in the north. I think it's also incredibly important to beef prices, especially in Indonesia. You know, we want to make sure that we have a long-term relationship with the shopper in the wet markets in Jakarta so that they can have an affordable form of protein.
The Indonesian ambassador to Australia has released a statement this evening saying Indonesia's live cattle permit decision isn't in any way related to political conditions or the state of Australia-Indonesia relations. The ambassador says decisions on the quarterly import permits for live cattle are based on economic considerations with the aim of maintaining the right supply of meat for Indonesian consumers. Barnaby Joyce isn't surprised that Australian exporters weren't warned of the dramatic cut in the quota.
Well, it is the nature that generally you at times don't hear about this to the last moment, so it is not unusual. It is a volatile market, and that's why I think it's so much better that we work towards an annual quota.
Well, as you're aware, North Korea threatens the death and destruction of South Korea and America on a regular basis, and that's usually accompanied by a volley of rocket fire into the sea. Fortunately, it rarely escalates. But for the South Korean residents on the island who sit in the disputed maritime border, it's a very different story. Our North Asia correspondent Matthew Carney reports.
On a clear day, the South Korean residents of Yeonpyeong Island can see North Korea. It's only 10 kilometres in the distance. And closer to shore, they watch South Korean warships chase off North Korean and Chinese fishing boats. The waters of the Yellow Sea are among the richest for blue crab. A chain of 5 South Korean islands defines the maritime frontier, known as the Northern Limit Line. The islands are heavily fortified and house long-range South Korean cruise missiles that can strike Pyongyang, the capital of North Korea, at any time. In November 2010, the conflict between North and South Korea almost erupted into full-scale war. Yeonpyeong Island was a war zone. The North had fired 200 shells. It was the first time since the end of the Korean War in 1953 that civilians were targeted. 2 islanders were killed, as well as 2 South Korean soldiers. 18 others were wounded. But artillery is not the only threat to their livelihoods. Chinese fishing boats are stripping the area of its prized blue crab. It's believed each Chinese boat pays the North Korean military about $10,000 a month for rights to fish in the disputed waters. If war does erupt again, it's likely to start in these islands, and that could drag in the United States and China. John Delury is a professor of international studies at Yonsei University in South Korea.
Even when the states involved may not want to go to war, there's always a danger when you have third actors. And the dangerous third actor are these Chinese fishermen who are coming over and operating both in North Korean and South Korean water. And so they increase the risk of an unidentified vessel that triggers some kind of unintended military conflict.
Matthew Carney reporting. The world's richest 2020 cricket competition, the Indian Premier League, has been dealt a huge blow, with two teams being banned from the competition for 2 years over an illegal betting and spot-fixing scandal. The bans come at the testifying time of the corruption-tainted Board of Control of Cricket in India, the BCCI, which critics say is well overdue for reform. Our South Asia correspondent Stephanie March reports from New Delhi.
There were chaotic scenes at this press conference in New Delhi yesterday.
There has to be pin drop silence so the verdict can be delivered.
The country's media gathered to find out the fate of two of the Indian Premier League's top teams, whose officials have been accused of tarnishing the reputation of the nation's favourite game. A Supreme Court-appointed panel announced the Rajasthan Royals, captained by Australian Steve Smith, and the Chennai Super Kings, skippered by India's MS Dhoni, would be suspended from the IPL competition for 2 years. The teams had been hoping for a hefty fine, but the panel's head, R.M. Lodha, explained why that would not be enough.
Because millions of people who are true lovers of the game feel cheated.
Officials from both teams have been found guilty of engaging in illegal betting during the 2013 IPL competition. Two officials, including Gurunath Mayappan, the son-in-law of Chennai Super Kings owner and now head of the International Cricket Council, N. Srinivasan, were banned for life from cricket-related activities. R.M. Lodha's criticism of Mayappan was damning.
Any agony suffered by him because of media coverage or any hardship that may have been caused to him is too small in comparison to the huge injury he caused to the reputation and image of the game, IPL and BCCI. If the reputation, image and the spirit of the sport are lost, what remains?
Indian cricket commentator Pradeep Magazine agrees.
Well, I think as far as IPL goes, it's a huge setback for them. Means a huge setback from a purely economic point of view.
The Indian Premier League is the richest 2020 competition in the world. The brand value is estimated to be $7.2 billion. Questions are now being asked about how the league will continue with only six teams. There's speculation two new teams will be introduced for next year's tournament. Even if that does happen, Indian cricket faces more upheaval in the short term. In a few months, the Supreme Court panel will hand down another binding report looking at ways to reform the corruption-tainted Board of Cricket Control in India, which administers the IPL and holds great sway over the game internationally. Pradeep Magazine again.
I think those administrative reforms would look into all these aspects of how the anti-corruption union functions, how conflict of interest has been allowed to flourish. And I think they will make a lot of constitutional changes in the board, which the board will have to implement and which probably will purge Indian cricket of a lot of wrongdoing.
A move that India's hundreds of millions of cricket fans would no doubt welcome.
And finally on the program, new research says Pacific Islands face an enormous cost to protect their coastline infrastructure from the impacts of climate change. A new study published by the journal Natural Climate Change has analyzed the vulnerability of rising sea levels and extreme weather events over 12 countries, seeking to determine the risk of critical infrastructure. One of the study's authors, Dr. Latit Kumar, from the University of New England in Australia, told Janie Tanaha, the cost of replacing infrastructure in harm's way is about $21 billion.
This is the first research that has been conducted at this scale, looking at every single island in those 12 countries. For most of them, we have point locations of every single built infrastructure on their land. So this includes all residential buildings, commercial, refineries, ports, even bridges. So very extensive data done for this full region, which nobody has done in the past. So there's lot of data out there to inform people what is at risk and what action can be taken.
How at risk are they?
Look, we have done this analysis in four bands. We have looked at all infrastructure within 0 to 50 meters of the coastline, then 50 to 100 meters, 100 to 200 meters, and then 200 meters to 500 meters of the coastline. The reason we used these four different bands was that for sandy or coral islands, which have low maximum elevations, the incline from the coast is much lower. So anything within 200 to 500 meters will be impacted. Whereas on a volcanic island, which have much higher maximum elevations, a distance of 0 to 50 meters may be much better because the incline is much higher. So those distances have to be looked in with what island type we are looking at.
Some of these island types you've looked at are Tuvalu, Kiribati, Marshall Islands, these low-lying atolls. All their infrastructure is 100 metres from the coastline because the island's only 100 metres wide. So what can these countries do? What does this tell them?
You feel sorry for some of these island countries. There's not much they can do. Many of these islands are less than 100 to 200 metres across. So most of the infrastructure falls very, very close to the coastline. One important use of this data is they can look and see where the assets are most at risk and if they are planning on new infrastructure, probably where to locate it. But they can't do much else. It's very difficult to pick up your building and move it to somewhere else, and especially if there's nowhere else to move.
And for the countries that can do something, the estimated cost for strengthening the infrastructure and stuff is $21 billion, you estimate. That's a lot more than a lot of these countries' GDP, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And the figure we quote over here of about $22 billion, that's only for the assets that we have assessed. The real cost will be much, much higher. For example, most of the tourism-related assets are on the coast. What I'm trying to drive at is when these assets are impacted, it is going to impact on the tourism market as well, and also the GDP of the country. So the flow-on effect is a lot greater than what the assets themselves cost. The figures that we show over here are much higher than the GDPs of many of the countries. And to expect them to be able to manage mitigation themselves is going to be extremely difficult.
And with that, we've come to the end of this edition of Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. If you want to contact us, our email address is focus@pcjmedia.com. On behalf of the whole team, I'm Keith Pell, wishing you well. Saying so long, take care. We'll see you again very soon. Bye-bye.